Okay, so I'm going to give Rebecca a call. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Thank you so much, Rebecca, that you're going to share your story with us.
So it was Christmas 2013. I got quite ill and I needed 2 weeks off work.
Mm.
And then I came back in the new year, 2014, and by February of that year, I needed to go on medical leave. I actually had a diagnosis of Lyme disease, which is quite contentious in Australia.
Yeah.
I saw a doctor about that, and I was declining quite rapidly. I was diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome as well. And it really, that getting sick in that Christmas of 2013 really just kicked something off, because the whole year of 2014, I was unwell. So I came back to work in March of 2014, and I believe it was by June, I was on medical leave again, because I just went downhill so quickly.
Yeah.
To the point where I was being sent home from work because I wasn't safe to work. I'd still drag myself every day, but I looked green. Mm. This is what I was told. I looked awful.
Oh, nice. That's a nice thing to be told.
Very, yeah.
You're like, what do I look like? The Wizard of Oz?
I know, the Wicked Witch of the
East. Yeah, exactly. I'm green. The first thing was you had a seizure. Tell us about that, when that happened.
So I was on medical leave the second time when I had this seizure. I was about to leave the house. I had an appointment. And literally was dressed, walking out the door with keys in hand. And I thought, wait a minute, I really don't feel well. And it was very sudden. So I cancelled my appointment. I said, look, I can't come. There's something wrong. I need to lay down. I'm so grateful I did, because about 10 minutes later is when that seizure stroke happened, and I would have been driving by then, and I would have been, if thinking 10 minutes, I would have been going quite a fast speed, so it would have been very unsafe had that happened while I was driving. So I laid down, this very strange thing happened. I was just shaking, and I called a national health hotline and I said, look, this happened. They said, go to the hospital. So I did. I went to emergency and they sent me home. They decided there was nothing wrong and sent me home.
Did they test you for a possible seizure or stroke?
They did nothing. And they sent me home. They believed I was faking it.
Yeah.
In fact, I was with my parents because I couldn't drive. I didn't feel safe to drive. I was with my parents, and they actually took my parents aside and said, we believe your daughter's ingested some sort of drugs and is having a really bad reaction. Now, that incident has led to me now being quite involved in advocating for healthcare, because even had I had some sort of drug that made me quite ill, I still deserve medical care. My parents were like, no, she hasn't. And I didn't even do any sort of tests. I saw my doctor, thankfully, a couple of days later, but that was a Saturday. I saw him a couple of days later and I said, oh, did you get any information from emergency? Because in Australia, they're supposed to send information on to your general practitioner or your primary medical person. And he said, no. I said, oh, okay. I presented to emergency. This happened. He was quite angry that he hadn't been alerted, and he did actually put in a complaint after that because they sent me home with obviously something quite seriously wrong. I remember sitting there, we went through that, and he said, okay, would you just tell me what happened? I said, I shook and this happened, and apparently my speech went a little bit funny. I've been very tired ever since. I've had a really bad headache and I just don't feel 100%. And he said, okay, I'm going to send you for an MRI. I said, okay. just in case, just to check, I want to tick off that box that it's not the worst case scenario, which is brain tumour. So I thought, oh, fantastic, went about my day, booked the MRI, had it, and then got a call 2 days later saying, oh, are you definitely coming in? And because I have worked in a medical reception position before, I knew what that meant. So I was sitting there and I had about 4 hours where I was just twiddling my thumbs and I thought, okay, they found something. I was prepared for some reason in my head. I thought I had MS, possibly because a friend of mine had been diagnosed with MS with not similar symptoms, but strange neurological symptoms. So that was in my head. I thought, okay, it's not a death sentence. There's treatment. There's ways around it and so on. And I go to my doctor thinking, oh, this is all great. It's fine. I'll be fine. And he said, well, you've got a brain tumour.
Were you on your own when you had to hear?
No, thank goodness. Because this had happened and I didn't want to drive, I didn't feel safe. My parents had driven me, and for some reason I turned around to my mum as I walked in because, look, I was 30 at the time. I'm 40 now, 40 this year. And I just turned around to my mum and said, do you want to come in? Oh. Don't know why, but I did, and I was so grateful because he gave us that news, and my mum was like, okay, it's okay if I get my husband in. She pulled my dad in, and I remember my parents crying. I didn't cry. I just sat there. I thought, okay, brain tumor. No, not quite what I was expecting. Mm-hmm. And I asked my doctor, look, what's prognosis? He couldn't give me that answer. But I do remember him saying, it's up to you. If you want to survive, you will fight. Mm-hmm. And if not, if you don't want to fight, you might as well give up right now. That's the best advice I could give you. Now, I know that sounds
brutal,
harsh. I believe that when you're dealing with such a significant and major health issue, you don't want it sugar-coated. Yeah. I don't like things sugar-coated. I wanted to know it. And I said, okay, great. Now, that stuck with me. I was in hospital a couple of days later, he contacted my now neurosurgeon. They did another MRI and they came back to me and said, oh, those funny seizures you're having? I said, yes. They're actually strokes. We found evidence of bleeding in your brain. So because they found that the intracranial pressure was high, there was so much evidence of that, that they brought forward my surgery and rushed me in. When I woke up after surgery and I had the stroke during the night, that stroke completely destroyed every motor skill I have. Couldn't speak. I couldn't move at all. I couldn't see. There was literally nothing I could do. I was laying in bed. Now, I don't remember the first 6 weeks. And I'm quite glad I don't.
Yeah.
But I do remember being in the rehabilitation wing of another hospital and thinking, why don't my arms work? Why can't I see? What is wrong with me? Why have I got 2 nurses who are carrying me to the bathroom to help me learn to walk again? What's wrong? I had no idea. I had no idea why I was in speech therapy. I could hear myself speaking quite normally and I couldn't understand why no one could understand me.
Yeah.
That was probably the strangest thing, was not being able to understand why others couldn't understand. And I didn't know. So when people were talking to me and I'm trying to talk back, I was getting frustrated because, to me, I was speaking clearly and I was speaking coherently. But to them, it was obviously quite garbled and very slurred.
I had the same thing. There was someone I was with and they were talking and I said something back and they were staring at me really funny. I was thinking, I've said something, haven't I? And they're going, yeah, and carried on. I was thinking, what did I do? He said, you said just the completely some word that meant nothing. And I was like, oh, but in my head, I didn't say anything wrong. I was like, I think I said it correct, but clearly I didn't. And you're just like, you feel a bit silly. And I was like, oh, great. It didn't give me much confidence to wanting to speak too much.
Absolutely. I felt exactly the same way. I refused to speak to anyone other than my immediate family and one or two friends for about 2 years.
Oh.
I wouldn't go into the shop. I was so conscious of that. I find the weather is one thing that quite affects me. Now, at the moment in Western Australia, we have the worst heat wave. We've had over 40 degrees. So I find that the weather, for example, or just fatigue, there are so many variables that will affect my speech.
Yes.
Even now, when it's almost 10 years later. So it is quite strange, especially, like you said, you feel silly. You think, I've said, I make perfect sense in my head. I've said this sentence and I've answered that query.
Yes.
And then you find out you haven't, or you've used the wrong word, or it's garbled or something, and it's so frustrating. I remember being in speech therapy thinking, why am I here? Why am I learning these, how to pronounce TH and PH and all these funny sounds? Because to me, I sound fine. Why can't anyone understand me?
Yeah. You said you still had another tumor.
Initially, they believed they got the whole tumor. But these other tumours, the three, were found later on. My neurosurgeon went back to the initial MRIs and found the tumours on those because they're quite deep in the brain, and back then technology wasn't actually that great. Now they come up quite easily, but they weren't showing that well. They were very difficult to find. I believe the only reason they found the big one was because it was so large. The other ones were so relatively small and they didn't quite present on the MRI images. Now they do. So I'm glad that he did go back and look at them and he found them and said, right, okay, they haven't grown. They still haven't grown, thank goodness. Still getting my regular MRIs to check them. But they've been there the whole time. As far as he is concerned, he believes I was born with him.
You found your confidence was very much at your low.
It started to come back, I believe, about 4 or 5 months later.
You must have been so scared.
And then I had to do it. I was terrified. Yeah. I thought, how my life has just collapsed into nothingness. I went into surgery. Okay, I was on medical leave from my job. I had a life and I came out and I couldn't even shower. I couldn't do anything. I couldn't even lay on my right side for 6 months. The vertigo was so bad. I just laid on my left side. I got bed sores in my ear from the pillow because I couldn't move. And I remember, why can't I turn my head? Why does everything taste funny? Why can't I see? Why can't I do this? Why can't I clap? When I was in rehab, it was around Christmas time and we had a choir come and sing Christmas carols and everyone was clapping as you do. I couldn't clap. I was like, why aren't my hands meeting? I was literally trying to clap and they're just passing each other. And I thought, I had no idea what had happened until my doctor came in, my GP came in and he told me. So I said, what's wrong? Why can't I do this? And he said, Rebecca, you've had a stroke. I thought, oh, that makes sense. As you do.
At least it gives some understanding.
Yes, because I thought, okay, so this isn't, I'm not imagining things. It feels like a nightmare. It's not a nightmare. It felt like it. But it was utterly terrifying to be in that situation where you have no clue what's going on. And I remember I was in the rehab ward I was in. I was the only patient who was there as a result of brain surgery or a stroke. Everyone else was there as a result of a vehicle accident. What I heard was horrific.
Mm.
People woke up. They didn't know where they were. They would be screaming, which they were in sheer terror, as you would.
Mm.
There were people walking around and they were lovely. They would sing. They would chat to you, but they had no capacity to understand what was truly going on, how to be safe, and it was utterly terrifying. To this point, I still struggle to go into a hospital, even if it's to visit a friend or something like that, because it's incredibly triggering for me.
Yeah.
And it was terrifying. And you take that terror with you, and knowing what had gone wrong was one thing. But when I got home, I was, goodness, probably for the first 3 years at least, I was too scared to go to sleep. My big stroke had happened in my sleep. I was too scared. I thought I wouldn't wake up. Every night I thought, okay, I'm lying here. What if I don't wake up? Wouldn't know if I didn't wake up, but do you know what I mean? I was just so scared.
Yeah.
You can't say that. And one thing I've learned, and I'm sure you have, I'm sure we all have, everyone who's dealing with a brain tumor, is that you're not often given that space to say these things because people can't deal with hearing them. I guess I found that living with brain tumors and having a stroke, I guess I, in particular, make the people around me really question their mortality. So when you say, I'm too scared to go to sleep because I might not wake up, they'll laugh it off or do something because of their own discomfort. So you're left to ruminate over these things. And I do feel this is why a lot of people like us struggle with depression and find it quite difficult to rebuild their lives, because we're not given that space to say these things, to say hey, because we're being through something so
traumatic,
something that, yes, that people, they cannot fathom on any level, no matter how well trained they are.
But it feels like you did go through a lot. Like, I went through a lot, but I feel like you really did go through an awful lot. When was it your vision did start coming back?
It did in 2015.
So when you started realizing certain things were starting to improve, did you have a chance to sit back and say, oh, hang on a minute, I'm getting better?
That's a really interesting question. No one has ever asked me that. I was very incredibly lucky. I am quite stubborn or tenacious. Depends what word someone would like to use. And I just had in my head that I wanted my life back. And I was going to try or die fighting to get it back. I had in my head that I was going to go back to full-time work in oil and gas. Don't ask me why I had that in my head, but I did.
You just wanted to have a job. You wanted to earn your own money. It's like back to that daily routine, yeah, is what you wanted back.
I wanted my, yeah, almost my life back. Mm. I am a huge animal lover. I've got my pets as from being an animal rescue. I'm a huge animal lover. And to be honest, I was so terrified I'd lose them. I'd lose everything that I had worked to build up until that point. I didn't want to move back home with my parents. I love my parents. They're wonderful. They're a huge part of my story. However, I didn't want to move back home at the age of 30. I didn't want to be defined by what happened to me. And I didn't want my life to be over. I know someone who had a family member pass away, and they had a stroke in quite young, in their 30s, like me. And they had what was called locked-in syndrome.
Oh, gosh, that's...
Now, yeah. I was incredible. Yes. Now, that would have been my prognosis. The medical professionals at the hospital, I had so many different specialists evaluate me, and they decided that I would never recover and that I needed to go to a nursing home.
Really?
And live out my days. Yes. Not even being able to change the channel. And when I was in hospital, I remember I'd think this person and I would cry. I wouldn't cry for me. I never cried for me, funnily enough. I would cry because I thought, wow, she lived 30-odd years and she passed away and she couldn't even change the TV channel. She couldn't change the volume. She couldn't even turn around in her bed. And I guess knowing that was also something that pushed me forward because I didn't want to be like that. And I still think of her. And I think of many other people who have had locked-in syndrome and they are left to rot in nursing homes around the world, and I cry for them because that was, not only was that always my fate, but I think that's just so wrong and it's such an awful thing. And I was so determined that I didn't want that to be me. I would do everything in my power to try and, I guess, move forward is the best way to describe it. So I did every session of physiotherapy, of speech therapy, of occupational therapy. I would practice. I would do my homework. They would assign me homework. I only saw them once a week. And when my dad would sit with me and we would do my exercises over and over. Now, I couldn't see for, say, 4 or 5 months. When my vision came back, I still couldn't see properly. It took a lot of eye exercises, possibly about 6 months. So that brings us to 2016. So for that 6 months and even beyond, my dad would have to read out my exercises for me because I couldn't read them. He would have to do that for me. So I'd be practicing my speech. I would be, goodness, what were my other things? Picking up really small items with my hand.
Mm.
I would be using weights on my hand. I remember I had to throw a soccer ball, just throw it up and catch it to get that motor skill back. And I just practiced. Because I couldn't see for so long, and even then, when my vision did come back, it was still a struggle too. I had to almost learn how to read again. There wasn't much I could do. I had horrific vertigo from the surgery, and that I was told that could happen. So the tumour was in my brainstem, that particular one, was in my brainstem and cerebellum. Your cerebellum looks after your fine motor skills, your gross motor skills, and any damage that can result in vertigo. So my vertigo was horrific. Eventually, I did vestibular therapy for my vertigo, but initially, I couldn't do that. I think it was about 4 years before it was at that point where I could do that.
Mm.
I had to wear a mask in the car, cover my eyes for motion sickness. That was something that would help. I could even watch TV. Just something moving was enough to make me
feel sick.
I was on so much medication, there was nothing. Eventually, and look now to this day, the rest of us still get motion sickness, but it's nothing like it was back then.
Mm.
When I was in hospital, I had so many well wishes around the world. I don't know how, but there were people literally in so many countries thinking of me, sending me their prayers, their kind thoughts, their good vibes, their love. And even now, that floors me that so many people took 5 seconds out of their day to think of me. Now I share my story and I try to pay that forward because I'm so grateful. I'm so incredibly grateful. I'm so thankful. These people who didn't know me from a bar or so, they didn't have to do any of that. Whether or not I believe in it is not the point. The point is that they did that for this woman in a country, another country, that I'd heard about maybe from a friend of a friend of a friend. And I feel like the best way I can show my gratitude to every single person is by speaking up, by sharing my story, by saying, hey, life happens, but you can move forward. It may not look like what you thought it would. My life now does not in any way look how I thought it would. But it's still amazing and I'm still grateful to be here.
Mm.
I'm so thankful. Yes, I live with inoperable brain tumors and I have to have MRIs every so often, and realistically speaking, they could grow at any time. But still, I'm not going to let that hold me back. I have been given this incredible gift of life. I don't want to waste it. There are so many people, you know, the statistics of brain tumors and our survival rates. And I feel like I owe it to all of those people who go before us who sadly have lost their battle. And I feel like I need to live for me, but for them, because they all fought just as hard as I have, just as hard as they fight as hard as you. And some of us don't make it. And I feel like the best thing I can do to honour those people who thought of me and sent all their goodness, but honour these people who go before us by living. Because it's something they all fought so hard for. Now, I don't know why I've been given why me and why not them. That's something I struggle with, that survivor guilt, so much. That to me, the nicest way I can honour them and honour their journeys is by living for all of us. Sharing my story, raising awareness, doing what I can to make this world a better place. I know that sounds incredibly cliched, but to me, that's the best way I can show my gratitude.
You wrote a book called Birthing the Butterfly, A Woman of Wisdom. Tell us a bit about the book.
The book is a collection of stories from women around the world who've gone through something. And I was approached and asked to be a part of this book. So I submitted a chapter and it's called Hope is Not a Four-Letter Word. And I share my story and I share how important hope is to me. and what I believe hope is. Hope isn't toxic positivity. Hope is realistic. Hope is looking forward and going, hey, okay, my life is never going to be what I wanted it to be, what I thought it would be, but it can still be something. Hope is gratitude. It is me showing my thankfulness that I have this gift of life given to me. Hope is so many things. I believe hope is something that it's life-changing. But it's also part of hope is acknowledging the bad and going, hey, I know this has happened to me and it sucks. Mm-hmm. There's no way of sugarcoating that.
Yeah.
But, and giving myself that space to grieve. Sometimes we need to, and part of hope for me is giving each other and ourselves that space to grieve, to think, to be. Because we can't always get it from other people. Sometimes we need to give it, or whether it be to ourselves or to others.
Yeah.
I do feel that living with brain tumors we're in a special club, aren't we? We're in a club that no one wants to be a part of.
Nope, nobody wants to be in it.
Very exclusive club that no one wants to be in it, mm-hmm. But we're in it. And I do believe that when you deal with something that affects the core of who you are, because your brain is you, it really gives us a different perspective on life. On so many things. So I thought, okay, I'll share my learnings, what I feel, what I've learned. And so I wrote my chapter and I've been asked to write another one, so they're releasing the second book in their series this week, and I'll be contributing again to the third.
That's amazing.
So I'm really looking forward to that.
Where can people get the book, or both of the books, when the other one comes
out? They're available on Amazon.
I think what we'll do is I'll make sure that the link is on the blog so people can go and have a look.
Okay, thank you so much.
Is there anybody you want to thank?
I would like to thank anyone and everyone who has been a part of it, whether it be a 5-minute conversation or a text message or a card or a prayer or a kind thought. I want to thank them and say thank you. I do believe I owe you my life. Why was I chosen? I don't know. That's a whole nother story, but I would like to thank you all, and I hope that I can make you all proud by doing what I do, and that it's a way of a suitable way of showing my gratitude.
Yeah.
My parents visiting me twice a day in the hospital, my sister and my best friend.
Yeah.
And they would come in, and I remember the nurses calling my room the party room, because I always had people coming to visit. My friends came to visit. My family came to visit. It was having that support emotionally and physically and mentally and in every way. That was also a huge factor in my recovery, because I could go to someone and go, oh my goodness, guess what? I had a shower by myself. I sat on the shower chair and had to turn on the water by myself. Like, to the average person, that's not really a big deal. But for us, when we have to relearn things,
yeah,
it's a huge deal.
Oh, yeah.
So having that support, I had my own little cheerleading team. So I could go, guess what? I did this. Guess what? I brushed my hair for the first time. or I heard my cats for the first time, or goodness, I can't even think of everything. There were so many first times. So it was really handy to have people who were excited for me, because not only that was encouraging, going, oh, wow, congratulations. And then I guess it's in one manner of speaking how maybe kind of people-pleasing was actually quite motivating, because it was like, hey, wow, I've gotten all this great feedback. It's nice to get that great feedback. What can I do next? What can I do next? What can I do next? And literally, that is how I got my driver's license back. That is how I learned to write again. It was like, hey, just doing these really infinitely small things, it gives me hope that my story with for other people going through, because I know how fraught the brain tumor journey is. And I know that perhaps I may be the only one that you've spoken to who's had a stroke afterwards. In fact, I don't think I've ever been able to find anyone who has either, but it can happen. And I also share my story because I want people to understand how important rehabilitation can be. I know it sucks. No one wants to do it. I hated every minute of it. I can tell you I really hated every minute of it, but I persevered, and it really can make a difference, especially when it comes to things like being able to live independently to a point, or being able to look after my cats, or even being able to drive down to the shop. I know some things may never be possible for some people, but it really does make it did make a difference.
Yeah. Oh, thank you very much for sharing your experience and being a part of Brain Tumor Awareness Month. I really appreciate it. And yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be a part of Brain Tumor Awareness in the UK, because it's something that affects us all no matter where we live.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you very much.